Here is a shocking heads up for parents about teen drug use. Teen drug use.
The Washington Post, the Drudge Report.
It could be toxic and harming.
Really irritates me. People would say that red-haired people don't have souls.
Hi, I'm AJ Hogue, the director of Effortless English.
We've given Australia's best-selling small sedan a serious workout.
We do. We do have souls, all right?
Welcome to the free 7 rules email course. Email course. Email course. Email course. Email course. Email course. Email course.
Sometimes it feels like we're drowning in information. And here's some more. This is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. And our topic today is information overload. Overload. Overload.
Advertising. Overload, social media. Overload, opinion. Comment,
advertising. Social media.
The web,
opinion.
Share prices.
Comment.
Facebook,
television.
Marketing,
the web.
Email,
share prices.
Twitter.
Facebook.
I think there's a simple definition of information overload, which is that it's the imbalance between the information that people feel they should absorb versus what they can absorb. And, of course, human progress has been marked by advances in technology that make information more available, that give people a sense that they should be absorbing more of that information, which leads to the sense of overload. And then I think we've seen time and again there's been an emergence of new ways of dealing with that increased availability of information.
That's Carolyn Webb, a management consultant with McKinsey & Company in London. And her advice for how to deal with the problem, well, that's still to come. Now, it's tempting to think of information overload as a modern phenomenon, but that's not the way Harvard Professor Anne Blair views it.
The term information overload is specific to our period, but there are equivalent terms that are used long ago, and in particular, the multitude of books, multitudo librorum. So the first person I think that really articulates books as the source of the problem, and too many of them, a source of distraction, is Seneca, first century of the Common Era in Rome. He's complaining about the elites who buy tons of books and then never read them, whereas they'd be better off focusing on two or three good books, mastering them carefully, and not letting themselves get distracted by these faddish new things. Of course, in his era, a book is a papyrus roll, and in fact, many books are multiple volumes, each one being a papyrus roll. So they're not exactly the same physical objects as what we have in mind, but I think the sensation, the concern that too many books are causing distraction, are causing a loss of quality of intellectual life, is clearly articulated. At the same time, there's also other people who are full of enthusiasm for the multitude of books. The two go hand in hand. We have overload because we have brought this overload on ourselves by accumulating and storing and wanting more. So it's always a double-edged theme.
Now, you mentioned Seneca, and you mentioned the frustration in the first century about what we would now identify as information overload. You move through time to the 15th century and to Gutenberg and the invention of the printing press, and the idea of information overload takes on a whole new dimension again, doesn't it?
Absolutely. In the first 50 years of printing, historians have counted about 27,000 works that were printed, and each work that's printed has siblings. If we have one copy that survives or a fragment of a copy that survives, it must have been printed in at least 200 or 300 copies. So we're talking millions of books by 1500 that were accumulating. They were for sale, always new books coming on the market, and then there's a used book market we don't know that much about, but these books don't just disintegrate, right? They stay on. And I think some of the first complaints really come in the early 16th century. So we've got Erasmus, for example. I love this line from his adages. Printers fill the world with pamphlets and books that are foolish, ignorant, malignant, libelous, impious, and subversive. And such is the flood that even things that might have done some good lose all their goodness.
So an irritable Erasmus.
Irritable Erasmus, exactly. Complaining about all these books. And of course, what does he do but publish more books?
Now, that initial excitement followed by then a frustration and a feeling of being overwhelmed, I mean, that is very familiar to all of us, you know, and we can imagine that with the online environment that we're in today. But is the difference really the sheer volume of material that is out there today? I know the printing press made an enormous difference at that time in the 15th century, but today we're talking about a vastly greater amount of material, aren't we?
Absolutely. The scale of information management and accumulation that we have is absolutely mind-boggling. And yet, I suppose from a basic human perspective, in terms of the overload that the individual experiences, it doesn't really matter that there are 1 million Google hits or 1,000 Google hits, you know, because you're not going to read more than 10 maybe or 20. So in a sense, I think maybe from the individual human perspective, the overload is sort of already present with much less stuff, even though now we have so much more. Of course, we also have different tools to deal with so much more and all kinds of automated methods of sifting through to try and find what we're looking for.
And that's important, isn't it? Because you make the point that what came out of the frustration, the feelings of being overwhelmed, you know, say in the 15th century, was that new techniques began to be developed for how we could manage all of this information. Do you have hopes that will again be the situation with us?
I certainly do have hopes. I'm confident that, we already have some tools, and obviously excellent minds are at work dealing with this problem. We certainly can't do without this information. What's the alternative? We don't want to shut it down and just decide, okay, we're going to, you know, put our heads in the sand and pretend that we want to ignore all this stuff. We have this material accumulated because of the labor of generations before us who often had it much harder than we did, digging up the old manuscripts and working by candlelight and by quill and all this and saving it and passing it on. And I'm loath, especially as a historian, to feel that we have any option but to husband it and to teach ourselves how to use it well, which, of course, computers are one method, but I think we also need to make sure we use our minds and not lose sight of the importance of human judgment in managing information.
The term information overload was first coined in Alvin Toffler's Future Shock in the 1970s. One of the interesting things is futurists very accurately predicted that we would have massive amounts of information. They predicted the internet. They actually predicted very accurately, from an economic perspective, the growth of the economy. They predicted the workforce that we would have available to us. What's very interesting, though, is the futurists got all that right, but one thing they uniformly predicted also was that we would be working many, many less hours today than they were in the 1970s. Yet all the research shows that the exact opposite has happened. Working weeks have increased and the number of hours expected of workers is continually going up. The common hypothesis for that is increasingly that although we have increased the efficiency of business, we have automated process, the quantity of information that we're retaining is adding enormous complexity to both government and business. And we're not on top of that. And that is actually where the real information overload is, and that's causing work and effort involved in running this new, more efficient society to constantly expand.
He's a partner at Deloitte Australia and their national leader of technology consulting. He's also the author of the book Information Driven Business. He's Robert Hillard.
We haven't just started riding on buses. We haven't just started going to visit a doctor. We haven't just started going to buy a loaf of bread. What we have just started to do in the last 10 and 15 years is to record those facts and hold on to them. Effectively, we now have this massive store of information and we're trying to find things to do with it. So once we have access to all of that information, people try to do things with it and they regurgitate it back to us. What we find is that we have a whole lot of facts and statistics being thrown at us. We find that the convenience of the internet means that it's much, much easier to throw half a thought in an email and send it off to somebody else and start a email chain that way. And all of these little drops add up to a wave in an ocean and we feel like we're being overwhelmed by it.
But it's the case, isn't it, that we're getting information from more sources than we perhaps did in previous times?
That's right. The sources existed previously, but what's happened is that we've got access to them. We've seen the globalisation of information. So where I might have had two or three trusted sources of information, I'm now effectively picking from around the world all of those things I like. It's the ultimate form of narrowcasting. If I'm interested in a particular topic, if I'm interested in model aeroplanes, I can find all the sources of expertise on model aeroplanes anywhere in the world. And if I choose to, I can completely surround myself with information about model aeroplanes.
Opinion, comment,
advertising, social media,
web,
opinion,
share prices,
comment,
Facebook,
television.
In other words, very few of us are simple victims of information overload. We're not passive targets. We're also consumers and producers of information. Caroline Webb from McKinsey & Company advises companies on strategies to better manage the information technology and communications revolution. She sees a world of swings and roundabouts.
I think there's quite a lot of evidence that we now have from the cognitive sciences that help us understand the impact that information availability is having for us. And I think, you know, it's important also to set that alongside the fact that every organization is also benefiting from the increase in pace, availability, access and so on of information. Let me start perhaps with the benefits. It's very clear that if you have a greater volume of information, then you can do more with that. You're able to see more into your businesses. If you have information that's more readily available, then you can respond more quickly. And there's obviously pros and cons to Twitter, but the fact that you will know if a customer is unhappy very quickly is a remarkable thing. And I think there's also a sense of democratization of information, that there's a greater ability to include more people in decisions and in the way that your organization operates, which I think all of which has come from the greater availability of information. On the suffering side, I think that what we've seen in organizations, and I wouldn't say that this is true of just certain organizations, I think this is true of everybody, is that multitasking is the general way that people cope with the increase in information. But it does, whilst make people feel efficient, it evidence suggests that people are making more errors and in overall terms taking more time. And it's really quite at odds with the fact that people do feel as if they're being more efficient by multitasking. I think the second big chunk of evidence is that the fragmented attention and time pressure also apparently leads to a lack of creativity in the face of complex challenges. And there are all sorts of neurological devices that sit underneath that linkage. But it's quite important if you think about the challenges that our organizations are having to deal with in as economic environments become ever more complex and challenging to deal with. And then I think something which we all feel a little bit familiar with is the idea that the constant sense of guilt versus the serenity of an empty inbox is creating a degree of stress. And arguably that's also compounded by a little bit of tension from the fact that it's harder to have real conversations where people are fully, fully present. I did say that I want to set that alongside the benefits. The benefits are huge, which are the increased visibility of what's going on in your organizations, the flexibility to respond quickly, the ability to include many more people in decisions and so on. So I think the challenge is, as it always has been, simply how do we make sure we get more of the benefits whilst minimizing the cost?
But just how well are businesses and corporate leaders responding to that challenge? Well, last year, Caroline Webb surveyed various chief executives and managers about the ways in which they were dealing with information overload, the coping strategies they'd identified. And her findings?
I think at the moment the solutions that I'm seeing are coming at the individual level rather than at the corporate level. There are some companies that have tried to address this at a corporate level, and it is a little bit of a challenge because it's such a complex system issue to address. But what I can share is what I've seen working, and I think those who are getting to grips with it do recognize that this is a cultural issue and that you don't shift behavior. Like a New Year's resolution, you don't shift behavior unless you look at the underlying assumptions and patterns that are holding you in your old ways of working. So those companies that are getting beyond New Year's resolutions are challenging the assumption that being always on is a way of raising performance and seeing always on as a bad investment decision, let's say. I mean, we don't work machines or run cars 24/7, and yet somehow we're moving towards that as people. And what we're picking up is that those who are thinking hard about the potential costs as well as the benefits are learning new skills and disciplines, perhaps you might say, in order to find the right way to interact with the information that's coming at them. We grouped it under three Fs, which made it easier to remember because of the alliteration. So we talked about how people are able to create more joined up chunks of time so that they're able to focus in a way that allows them to do their best thinking against the really most important issues. We also talked about filtering, how to filter more firmly and intelligently to deal with what Clay Shirky has called filter failure. In other words, the fact that our old-fashioned filters aren't really modern enough to deal with the modern challenges of information overload as they present itself to us now. And what that does is it requires us to get much clearer on our comparative advantage as leaders, to use a term from economics. And then the last F after focus and filter is actually how to switch off, to forget, how to give our brains a rest and allow space for the subconscious, non-linear processing part of the brain, the part that comes up with answers to complex issues when we've slept on them, you know the sort of thing I mean, or when we've zoned out in the shower. And it's, again, cognitive sciences that are giving us more and more pointers towards the fact that it's important to be able to do that. And, of course, people are doing these focusing, filtering and forgetting steps in many different ways. And what you'll find by talking to anyone who's seriously thinking about this is that they're experimenting wildly. They'll try one thing, see whether it works, and they'll try something else. And it's very easy to get discouraged when you try one approach and it doesn't quite work. And I always encourage people to keep trying. And ultimately, I'm also in the same situation myself as a leader.
And this is Future Tense, broadcast via RN and Radio Australia. And you can follow us on Twitter at RN Future Tense or one word.
Okay, now we have to take a quick diversion for a moment because I don't know about you, but I'm starving.
Welcome to McDonald's, place your order when you're ready.
Oh, hi. Can I have a bacon and egg McMuffin, please, and a regular flat white? Actually, make that two McMuffins, two bacon and egg, and one of the sausage ones. No, actually make that two bacon eggs and two sausage, and some of those potato things. Better make that two of those as well.
That's all today? Shut through the first window.
Now, one of the ways to think about the way in which we consume information is to draw an analogy with the way we consume junk food. But I need to eat, so I'll let US digital political consultant and author Clay Johnson take it from here. He co-founded the company Blue State Digital, which ran Barack Obama's digital and social media campaign back in 2008. And like every American, he also has a book out. It's called The Information Diet.
When we talk about information overload, it places the blame on the wrong thing. We don't say that, you know, obese people are suffering from food overload. They're suffering from either eating too much food or too much bad food and not enough good food, depending on their, you know, economic status and ability to get good food. And I think the same thing's going on with information. We're not suffering from information overload, we're suffering from information overconsumption. And the idea here is, you know, we used to have this concept of ignorance, and ignorance used to be about not having enough access to information. Well, now we have an abundant access to information, and it turns out that the overconsumption of information or the misconsumption of information can really cause us to be just as ignorant as a lack of information in the first place. So, for instance, in Washington, I was walking past the White House, and there was a man holding a sign over his head that said, keep your government hands off my Medicare, and Medicare is a government-run program. So it's impossible for government to keep its hands off of Medicare because Medicare is government. And I stopped and talked with this guy, and he was a rather well-educated person who was only consuming information that confirmed his beliefs. And that's the real central premise of my book, which is who wants to hear the truth when they can hear that they're right? We have news networks that are designed to affirm our beliefs rather than tell us the truth. And it's not necessarily their fault. That's what we tell them that we want. Just like it's not McDonald's fault for selling too many hamburgers when it turns out hamburgers just taste delicious and we're wired to like them and we're wired to want to be affirmed and we're wired to want to be told to be afraid of things too.
Why do you think it's become popular to blame information itself, to talk about information overload and not our own personal consumption?
Well, I think it's a hard problem, and I think we don't know nearly enough about how the science of our information consumption. We don't know about, you know, how information directly affects our brains. It's very similar to how we were with food when the first Western diets were being invented. The calorie was a unit of measurement used to measure the efficiency of steam engines when we first started talking about healthy diets and fighting obesity through measuring our food intake. And I think we're in the same place when it comes to information. And I also think it's just easy to blame technology and to blame information and to make a boogeyman rather than accepting responsibility, both individual responsibility and a societal responsibility.
And now you have some recommendations for how people can build for themselves a healthier information diet. And I want to come to those in just a second. But some people would say, you know, like junk food, even if you try to exercise moderation with the information that you take on, it's very difficult to do that in an environment where there is information excess, where it's almost impossible to get away from information coming at you from screens or from phones, from everywhere. It's there. We live in that sort of world.
Right. Before I wrote this book and before I started going on an information diet myself, I found myself being a virtual symphony walking down the street with my phone beeping, playing little tunes for, you know, all these different services that were commanding my attention. And it is very difficult. It's also very difficult to be a vegan or a vegetarian. But these are the challenges that we have to face. You know, human beings are designed to live in very scarce environments. We're designed to store a bunch of fat so that we can live through the winter. And it turns out that living through the winter isn't very hard anymore because we've mastered fire and we mastered heat. We're wired for scarcity, and now we live in a land of abundance. And scarcity had its own problems, but abundance does too. And we need to be careful with abundance that we realize what it is that we're up against.
Given that we live in an increasingly digital world and that information is tied to so many aspects of our lives, it is difficult, isn't it, to quantify how much information you are actually taking in.
And it's difficult to quantify the consequence of taking in that information. Clicks have consequences. So unlike food, you know, your food sometimes has a moral consequence to it. If you're supporting the meat industry, for instance, they might be doing some things. If you are an animal rights activist, that you might have some ethical issues with. But your information consumption, especially online, has a whole bunch of ethical consequences to it, because every click that you make is a vote to an editor somewhere saying, this is something I want to hear more about. Every search that you do on Google is a vote to tell editors to write more stuff about that search. And so we have this feedback loop going on that's producing a lot of content that isn't particularly useful. And when you know, study up on Kim Kardashian or the celebrity junk that's out there, you're actually telling the media to write more stuff about that.
Now, some people have responded to this information overload or information consumption problem by taking a holiday, by trying to have a break, almost like a fast, if you like. You're not a fan of that approach, are you? You don't think it's effective. Why not?
No, I don't think that's a good idea, because I think, again, we need to learn from food. The world of food and our history of the diet has a lot to teach us about how to go on a proper information diet. In the world of food, what we did is we, for a long time, said we should focus on quantity and we should just not eat a lot, and that will make us skinny. And that's a very, I think now, prehistoric way of looking at a diet, and a very unhealthy way of looking at a diet, because I think it made a lot of people sick. It invented things like the eating disorder, which has really killed a lot of people. And really, a healthy information diet is about consuming quality information and developing habits and healthy choices. When you decide that you're going to go, you know, on a social media vacation or just to unplug, all you're going to do is binge when you get back. Or, you know, rush to your email as soon as at your earliest convenience. It's not going to actually create any permanent habitual change in your life. What you want to do is develop a framework for yourself where you can consume deliberately and consume consciously and have control over your information intake like you have control over your food intake.
All right, now let's go back to your recommendations. What do you recommend to people they can do to have a more balanced information diet?
Well, the first thing I'd say is to measure your intake. There are lots of services out there. My favorite one is called rescuetime.com. What they do is you install this on your computer, and it just simply starts measuring what it is that you're taking in, and you can set variables in the service that say, this is stuff that's productive for me and this is stuff that's not. And then once a week they email you a total sum of what it is that you're consuming. But you can go online at any time and see what it is that you're taking in. And then when you're not at your computer, keep a diary. Keep a journal of what it is that you're taking in. And make some decisions. You know, if you find that you're an over-consumer, then maybe consume a little bit less. The other thing is, you know, if you find that you're consuming a lot of news that maybe makes you nod your head a little bit too much, or stuff that you agree with, then maybe it's time for you to focus on either some more diverse opinions or to get a more in-depth understanding of what it is that you're nodding your head to. The third thing I'd say is it's really important to understand what the intent of the media is that you're consuming. So I recommend that you try and eliminate as much of the notifications that are coming to you from the various online services wherever you're at. So set your phone up to not pop up when you get a new Twitter message, and set your computer to not send you an alert every time you get a new email, and to eliminate all those little red boxes that are around, you know, Facebook and Google Plus and all that stuff, so that you are consuming deliberately. Because these companies, if you understand the means behind what it is that they're doing, they're setting up these notifications so that you come back to their services and look at more advertisements. And what you want is to have a proactive and deliberate relationship with these services so that you're going to them rather than them consistently nagging you to come to, reminding you to use their service so that you can look at more advertisements.
Now, there are some people who, with, say, the consumption of food and alcohol, would say that the part of the solution is increased regulation by the state. Now, that's an arguable point, but it seems to me that with information, that's a potentially dangerous solution, isn't it, given freedom of speech?
Yeah, it's very dangerous. I mean, you know, that causes some big problems with a free press. You know, I think it really has to be regulated personally. And that's why I'm on this mission to raise people's awareness about this. This is the one thing that government can't really regulate well. Government can make water cleaner. It can make the air that we breathe cleaner. It can make sure that the food that we eat doesn't poison us. But it can't be the fact-checking body for the entire world without becoming corrupt. And so we have to build our own forms of information diets ourselves. Government can't force us all on an information diet.
Clay Johnson, co-founder of Blue State Digital and author of the book The Information Diet. There's a link, of course, on our website. And there are also links to information about our other guests, Anne Blair, the Henry Charles Lee Professor of History at Harvard, Robert Hillard from Deloitte Enterprise Information Management, and Caroline Webb from McKinsey & Company in London, including her report detailing what she called the three Fs. Next week, we'll zoom in on one of the really, really annoying aspects of the information overload phenomenon, the growth of spam.
As long as we have the incredible range of insecure and unpatched operating systems floating around for personal computers that we do, and to some degree, as long as we want to keep the level of forward innovation happening in the social space, which means not locking down how people participate, not deciding what an acceptable tweet is, not having moderation at every stage, we want the freedom that these things can provide. But one of the consequences of that is that they will always provide open space for spammers to take advantage of.
Not the sandwich meat, the curse of the online world. The future of spam, next on Future Tense.